This episode is brought to you by Videoblocks.com. Go to Videoblocks.com/notalone to save 84% on an annual subscription to one of the most comprehensive and highest quality libraries of stock footage out there. That's Videoblocks.com/notalone.
Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
Tonight, we're talking about the Grandmaster Spook. That's supposed to be like a play on words for like Grandmaster Flash, right? But Grandmaster Spook, you don't...
Nope. Uh-uh.
Uncultured
what?
Swine.
Yeah, baby.
The Grandmaster Flash of the Spookernatural. Mothman. It's Mothman. We're doing Mothman.
He's the spookiest?
He is very spooky.
I don't know.
Maybe not the spookiest, but the reason he's the Grandmaster isn't necessarily because he is the spookiest, but rather because I believe, and we'll get into this more on episode 2.
That he's an alien.
Like 5 hours from now.
Oh,
I believe
no. That
he is one of the entities at the top of the Spookernatural paradigm.
So, wait. The Spookernatural paradigm.
Yes.
Okay, on the
it's
top
like
of
the
a
food
pyramid.
Okay.
The food pyramid
but
of
with,
weird stuff.
Yeah, with spooks.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
At your very
what's
bottom.
The, yeah, what's the
at
base?
Your
what
very
makes
base,
the base of the Spookernatural pyramid?
You have those little blue guys in the coveralls that Whitley Strieber saw, right? The
okay.
little worker class.
Yeah, so little grays.
You also have...
Worker grays.
You also have like the baby feet... And the little hairy dwarves.
Is it just because they're small?
Yes.
Okay.
There are, well, and also because there are many of them.
So
and
that's
they
where
are
leprechauns and goblins are also at?
I would say that leprechauns are
ooh,
probably like
leprechauns
the,
are
the cruel
be...
masters of, they're tier two. They're the cruel masters
ooh.
Of
so
tier one.
They're just like the smarter versions of tier
yes.
one? Okay.
So you're getting there, right? It's not that they're small at the bottom, although
okay.
that's part of it.
It's the small institute.
They are not as wise and are
dude,
meant for manual labor.
If I've learned anything from D&D, wisdom and intelligence does not factor together.
It doesn't.
They're
yeah,
not
no.
they're not coinciding.
No. So and then as you go up the pyramid, right, you have the cruel masters of tier 1, the leprechauns. Above them you have, I don't know, how many tiers are we going to put here? Let's do 5.
Hey, it's your pyramid.
Okay. And then above them you have Nessie. And then above them, that's where you start getting into your like short grays, right? And you start getting into like the wolfmen, for instance.
Okay.
These skinwalkers.
So
right?
I'm feeling more spooky natural things occurring.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then at the very top, you have like your tall whites. You have your Mothman. You have your great voice. You have the most intelligent and the orchestrators of the
gosh,
Jersey Devil
monsters and stuff.
Well, I don't know if the Jersey Devil is actually probably closer to like tier 2, maybe tier 3. But if somebody wants to illustrate this, do that. Also, by the way, we got fan art for the first time. That was dope. Thank you.
That was beautiful.
It was Clover. Clover, you're fantastic. That made us both so happy. Anyway, that was a nice way to start the show. A nice little 4-minute long tangent. I'm not going to flag it. We're keeping
cool,
it
let's
in.
Keep it going, man.
So
the Spooknatural Pyramid.
Mothman at the top.
Mothman at the top of the spooks.
Baby feet at the bottom. Everything else in
aww.
Between. It's good.
Little baby feet at the bottom.
Little baby feet. Now, I was telling Jason this. We can't talk about Mothman without talking about the man who made the Mothman famous. Without talking about the other events at the same occurring at the same time in the same area. It Mothman himself, I could list the sightings in 10 minutes and be done with it. And that would be all it was.
But Sam likes to torture me.
But I enjoy long-winded rambling. And therefore, this is at least a two-parter. Most likely a two-parter, because I do have other things scheduled and planned. We'll see. But this isn't necessarily a story about Mothman as much as it is a story about John Keel. Now, John Keel was an American journalist and author. He served during the Korean War. He claims that there he was trained in the art of writing propaganda. Now,
You don't say. Now he talks about aliens.
Now, he travels throughout the world, from the Near East to the mountains of Tibet, down south, everywhere you can go, he has been. He starts out as a pulp writer, but once he's out of the army, he starts releasing books on more mystical and esoteric phenomena. His first book is called Jadu, and it covers his time searching for the magic behind the Indian rope trick, which is a popular illusion used by stage magicians.
What is that trick?
It's like a guy climbs up a rope, but the rope isn't attached to anything.
Okay, so it's like gym class.
But there's no top. Yeah.
So you just go on forever?
No. Like, there's an end to the rope.
It's just...
But the rope is not secured
to anything.
So what,
is it just like a super stiff rope and just solid glue?
Something like that? I don't know.
Okay. Well, I mean...
I didn't actually look up like
what the actual trick portion of it is.
Yeah, I know what it is. It's a guy climbing up a rope.
Uh-huh.
And it was hailed as like the greatest... Hey, if you want to hear more about magic tricks... Sorry. Illusions. They're illusions.
No, they're magic tricks.
Go listen to Illusion. It's an amazing podcast that tells like the stories of famous magic tricks. So, but anyway,
that'd be interesting.
It was once called, it is very interesting. It is once called like the greatest illusion in the world. So, and John Keel has had an interest in stage magic since he was a young child, mm-hmm. about the age of 12.
That's what I got from his Wikipedia page.
Right? So.
That's how I do it, guys.
Like we said, Jadu covers his time searching for the magic behind the Indian rope trick, as well as the Himalayan cousin of the Bigfoot, the Yeti. And from there, he begins to become more and more heavily invested in what is known as Fortiana, or... what also may be referred to as anomalous phenomena. The term Fortiana is coined after the name of the late great Charles Fort, who devoted his life to exploring the unknown. I myself would consider myself as a Fortian, which is one who tries to find out the truth behind these anomalous phenomena. The majority of your favorite podcasters and researchers as well most likely consider themselves Fortians. And John Keel is undoubtedly, as far as research goes.
So when did Charles Fort do all this stuff? Like, was his era?
He was in the late 1800s.
Okay.
Let me double check that.
What kind of spooky natural things were going on then? The UFO craze happened essentially in the 50s, right?
Right, so, but you still had UFOs. They just weren't as, you just weren't as crazy about them. He liked to study... some of the stuff that modern science just like turned its nose up at. One of his biggest thing was, like I said, the anachronistic, which means out of time or objects out of time, wherein that like there are the sorts of reports of like, oh, there was this watch. This one's true. There was like a watch that was found in a Chinese grave from like 2000 BC.
Gotcha.
And there was a wrist rock.
So it's like, man, where did I leave my keys? It's in a different time period.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha.
It is through the veil of space time.
I don't think your tile will help you there, mm-hmm. Sam.
Other things were like fish falling out of the sky, stuff like that. Just the kind of weird stuff. And he's like an inspiration, man.
I feel like the kind of stuff that he'd be involved with, like, is straight out of a Lemony Snicket. Like book,
yeah. He seems
that's
like
kind of how
seems
I
like
feel.
A character in a Lemony Snicket book. Yeah, if Mr. Poe like suddenly really liked strange, spooky stuff,
yeah,
ghosts, that sort of stuff as well. But yeah, he
sweet,
was
all right.
It was like he was the man who made the mysterious famous or something like that. But yeah, he without a doubt is one of the most influential people when it comes to paranormal activity research, anomalous research, stuff like that. And Kiel is one of the greatest Fortians of all time. His most well-known work, without a doubt, is The Mothman Prophecies, which was published in 1975, cataloging the events of the Mothman Flap. And a flap is basically where you have, like, a beginning and an end, and in the middle you have the flap, which is an increased...
That is such a horrible word to describe something. The flap?
That's just what it's called.
It's so weird.
It's a flap. It's a Mothman flap. But the point is that there are more sightings within this period than within a normal... Like, with the Mothman flap, more sightings of Mothman within that 14 months than before. So it's an uptick in sightings. And because
Mothman was around before the 60s?
You're right. But that's more for episode two.
That was more of a question.
Yes. Okay. That's more for episode two. Yeah, so, and the other thing is that because it has a beginning and an ending, right? The Mothman Flap started on November 15th, 1966,
right,
and ended on December 15th, 1967.
70s. Yeah. 70.
What?
I was being dyslexic for a moment.
I'm gonna give you the benefit
of
the doubt.
Thanks, dude.
The Mothman Prophecies, published in 75, cataloging the events of 66 to 67, The Mothman Flap.
So it took him 9 years to... write and publish his book?
Yeah, he wasn't going to, pretty much. He as a researcher, he has his own little, like, he goes, he does his research, he collects it. Sometimes he writes books, sometimes he doesn't. He had mentioned the Mothman and, like, those 26 sightings actually come from a book he published before the Mothman Prophecies, which was called Strange Creatures from Time and Space, which was published in 1970. And then from there, he decided a few years later, I think it was one of, he kind of had like this sort of like a mentor person named Ivan Sanderson, who was a zoologist. And then also another UFO researcher named Gray Barker, who they both were like, hey, man, you should really write a book about this. And he was like, I don't know if I want to. I don't know if people want me to. And then he finally decided to do it. And it's a good thing he did. I mean, Mothman was written about and has been written about many times by many people, but without a doubt, John Kiel is, like, he is the man who kept Mothman alive, and at least in the public mainstream imagination. In the movie The Mothman Prophecies, which is a good film, actually, we're not going to go into the movie right now.
Okay.
And the reason is, keep your eyes peeled for we're... What?
Never mind.
I don't know if Jason can make it on. I'm definitely going to be there. Hopefully Jason will be there. But we're going to be on the podcast based on a true story, wherein our good friend Dan, he like watches movies and then tells you about the true story behind him. We're going to be on that, talking about the Mothman Prophecies. So we're actually not going to talk about the Mothman Prophecies right now, other than to say it has characters based on John Kiel and some of the other people who we come across in his stories.
All right.
So, at the time when the Mothman was active and he was in Point Pleasant, he went to Point Pleasant during this time. He lived there for months on end. During this time, he was an accredited journalist. He was a member of the North American Newspaper Alliance, which is a syndicate whose members included people such as Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And Kiel is also most well known for the popularization of a term that we're going to be focusing on almost exclusively in part two, but factors very, very heavily into this, which is the Men in Black. He is also often hailed as one of the founding fathers of ufology, along with J. Allen Hynek and Jacques Vallée, as well as Bud Hopkins. I'd recommend, if anyone wants to start down this path of learning more about UFOs, that is the essential place to start, is with these four men, Kiel, Hynek, Vallée, and Hopkins. I've got a lot of books by them. They're fantastic. If you want to learn more or want book recommendations, let me know. We set up a Goodreads account for the show. So you could go to Goodreads and search for your friend Not Alone podcast, and you can see what we're reading for the show. That's pretty cool. But anyway, last note about Kiel, he was known to be a great judge of character, but also be a discerning researcher. In one article from the Raleigh Register titled Flying Saucer Expert Here in November, They state that Kiel readily admits that he figures a considerable number of the reports, being UFO reports and Mothman reports, seem to be the result of overactive imagination, hallucination, hoax, or the like, but not all. They stated that during the course of their lunch with him, he appeared to be well-grounded in the rudiments of science, as well as quite intelligent, and this is echoed by pretty much everybody who worked with him, especially those in Point Pleasant itself. Now that's John Kiel. So we've got that framework done. We've got him there. Next up, anything you want to say about that? Just to be sure?
Now hold it.
Okay, all right. Next up, we have the Mothman himself. The Mothman of Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. He makes his first appearance on the scene around 11:30 p.m. on November 5th, 1966. I say he, it. We're going to refer to it as it, because even though it's Mothman, we don't really know its gender. Tell. We don't want to assume that. So they have this encounter, right? And it's spooky, it's creepy. They call it a bird. They say it's a bird of some kind. It's unlike every bird I've ever seen before, but it's a bird. And then the story makes it so all of the newspapers for the first day or two say, like, four people see this big old bird that's really weird and has man legs. Four people see it. Eight people, 12 people, 16. And then after a few days, somebody picks this up, like some guy in Chicago or something, and he just decides, I'm naming this thing Mothman. And he just starts writing Mothman. Everyone's like, that's a great name.
Yeah, and he picked it up from Batman, right?
Yeah, it's from Batman.
Was Mothman a villain?
I have absolutely no idea, okay. But I'm going to hope so. But assume so.
I have to get this out of my system.
Yeah.
Mothman.
Mothman.
There we go.
I love it. Now, he makes his first appearance on the scene around 11:30 p.m., November 15th, 1966. It's cited by two couples, Steve and Mary Mallett, and Roger and Linda Scarberry. Now, the couples saw the apparition in an area that very quickly becomes central to the Mothman story, which is what Kiel refers to as the TNT area, which is where, you may be able to guess, an area where there was TNT that was manufactured during World War II.
Yep, just munitions in general.
Mm-hmm. Its official name is the... Oh, what is it? Its official name is the West Virginia Ordnance Works. It encompasses 33 square kilometers. It has 100 steel and concrete domes with heavy steel doors wherein the finished munitions were placed. And it is pretty spooky. It's pretty spooky now. It was pretty spooky then.
Well, I mean, after World War II, it actually got just essentially converted into a wildlife preserve.
Yes, yeah, they figured they might as well.
Which adds the spook.
Yeah.
I feel like it's probably not well kept.
No, and it's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it was still a popular place for people to go. You know, it's like kind of like Lupe was saying about the Pine Barrens back in episode 4, how they just would drive into the pines and hang out and have a good time and party.
Mm-hmm.
People did that with the TNT area all the time. Even it was even so popular of a place that the Scarberries and the Mallets, they just felt like, hey, we want to meet up with somebody. We want to hang out with people. Let's just drive into the TNT area. I'm sure we'll find somebody. There's always somebody there. But for some reason...
But doesn't that mean they're just going to run into someone trying to get down?
Well, not necessarily. You had a variety of events and activities.
Okay, all right.
You did have that.
Just, I'm expecting, hey, guys.
Hello.
What are you doing in there? It's a little foggy.
You want to hang out? You had that for sure, but you also had, like, there were these long straightaways. People would go drag racing. People would just get out and set up chairs and sit around and talk and camp and drink. It was a great time.
The 60s.
Things
were simpler.
I know, right? Now, they do. They say, well, let's go to the TNT area. I'm sure we'll find somebody to hang out with. They're looking all over. They're driving in the area. They're staring out their windows into the darkness. One of the first things that they notice that's a little weird, you know, like Jason just said, it's a wildlife preserve, so be it. But they do notice a dead dog by the side of the road. It was a medium to large sized dog. They're driving around. They end up doubling back, and they realize that the dog carcass is gone just a few minutes later. Now, they're unable to find anybody. They decide it's time to call it quits, and they head out of the area, passing by the old power generator plant. Now, Linda is the first person to react. She gasps audibly, and everyone looks over to see what she has seen when Roger slams on the brakes. All four members of the car saw the same thing, described the same thing, and offered to take a polygraph test to prove it. It started with the eyes. They all reported seeing two bright circles about 2 inches in diameter, which is about twice the size of the typical human eye. The eyes were glowing. They said it wasn't eyeshine. They knew what eyeshine looked like. And whereas eyeshine requires ambient light and then it reflects it there, these eyes seem to be glowing of their own accord. And the eyes were hypnotic. All four of the individuals felt like they could not look away. They felt like it was trying to draw them in, like it was trying to affect their mind. And as they looked for another moment, the creature that surrounded the eyes became more clear. It appeared to be 6.5 to 7 feet tall. It was grayish brown in color, and they said it looked like a man. Its legs were thick, sturdy, muscular legs. It stared at the car for a moment, and then it started to shuffle off towards the entrance of the generator plant. Now the couple is spooked, and they gun it. They head out towards Route 62, towards home, and they see on the side of the road, on a little hilltop, they see this same creature, or potentially one that looks just like it. As they pass it, they claim it unfolds bat-like wings with a 10-foot wingspan, and then it simply ascends. It doesn't flap its wings. It doesn't show any sign of physical movement or activity other than it simply lifts up into the air and begins to follow them. Now, this detail is significant because within those first 3 or 4 days, there is, in the newspaper reports that I was able to find, all of the witnesses say it has wings. None of them specifically state that it doesn't flap its wings. They just say it got up and it follows us, but they also don't say that it does. So it's like one of these weird little details that as John Keel is talking to everybody, gathering his information and writing the book, he realizes, wait a second, nobody's talking about the wings flapping. Why is nobody talking about the wings flapping? In any case, it rises into the air and it begins to chase them. In their desperation, the couples end up going pretty near to 100 miles an hour, and they claim that the creature kept pace with them evenly the entire time.
You're telling me 57 Chevy could hit 100 miles an hour?
Near 100. I think so.
Okay.
I think so. You want to look it up?
I would love to actually know what its top speed is.
So I'm on a ChevyTalk.org.
I love it.
And they're talking about the 1955 to 1957 Chevys, stock restored show. This fella is saying he's got a 55, it looks like. He did 90 today. Well, today, 13 years ago. He did 90 easy with nothing there. This guy says in his sedan, which is probably what it was,
yeah,
he had it up to 110.
All right, so it is possible.
It's possible. It's possible. According to the good people of ChevyTalk.org, it is possible.
All right.
Anyway, so they're going 110 miles an hour. And
no, they're going 100 miles an hour.
Sorry, they're going 100
miles an hour. Don't add the extra 10.
Why not?
Because
you make a good point, though.
Like,
so
that's really, really freaking fast.
It's very fast, and I'm sure that it took them a little bit of time to get up to 100 miles an hour. It's definitely not safe, but it's so be it. But the entire time that it's getting up to 100 miles an hour, this creature seems to be following it pretty much the exact same speed. So It's like we could have got
kite Shem. Got attached to the back of their car or something.
I guess that's probably one of the most like strenuous theories I've ever heard. But I guess anyway, you get this feeling that
you've seen those balloon missiles, right?
That you probably could have been caught, but for some reason it didn't. In any case, Mary Mallet also claims to have heard some sort of noise coming from the creature as it pursued them, a squeaking like a mouse. I'm going to be honest, if you're making your car go 100 miles over a dirt road, you may
it
not
could
be
a
hearing
couple
what
things
you're thinking
causing
you're
that
yeah,
thing.
Like, I like to give people the benefit of the doubt and like take them at their word. 16-year-old car, or no, 15-year-old car going 100 miles an hour, it may have just been that. But in any case, Mary says it's coming from the creature.
Now, oh, it's only 10. 10-year-old.
Oh, that's not...
Still, I mean...
It depends on the upkeep. Anyway.
Exactly.
Now, the couples, they drive directly to the Mason County Courthouse and reported what happened to Deputy Sheriff Millard Halstead, who immediately jumped back into his car and followed them back to the area. As they approached the TNT area, Halstead's police radio blasted out a very, very loud sound. It drowned out the voice of the dispatcher, and it sounded to him like it was a tape recording of a man speaking, but it was sped up. This is the official arrival of Mothman in Point Pleasant. But, like we said, this is something where there's so much going on, there's so many different components. We simply have to take some side detours here and there, and this is going to be one of them. It focuses around that sound that the deputy heard, okay? There is this idea that UFOs and Mothmen, okay, both of these things.
Okay.
They have things in common, but they also cause different, like, problems, or specifically when you're looking at electronic equipment fails or misfunctions around these things.
From my memory, I remember at least cartoons, or maybe it was a few alien movies, to where pop culture has picked that up a
right.
lot as a heralding of incoming alien activity.
Right. So you have, not only do you have like your typical, like, I pulled out my cell phone, I pulled out my camera, and it wouldn't take a picture, which is one of the more commonly reported things, but you have, especially in this specific case, the Point Pleasant cases, you have a lot of weird things happening with sound. So you have Millard Halstead's radio working perfectly before that. He's using it, he's tuned into the dispatcher, he's listening, making sure things are okay at home as he's following these couples out to hunt the Mothman, not knowing that's what he's doing. And suddenly you have this sound like a man speaking very quickly, as if you're fast forwarding a tape recorder. This was not unique to Millard's radio. In fact, this same phenomena was reported by a number of UFO and Mothman witnesses during this period of time, because that's the other thing that we haven't necessarily touched on yet, but we're going to. The Mothman flap also coincides with one of the largest UFO flaps nationwide, but also especially in West Virginia and Ohio. So you have people talking about getting, you know, if they witness UFOs, they'd get calls afterwards. The calls would be to their home phone. Some of them were even unlisted numbers. Some of them were numbers that had just been changed and not given out to anybody. These calls would come through and they'd answer and they'd hear this sound like a man speaking very quickly. You'd hear these sounds like Morse code beeps coming through, or just electrical squeals and high-pitched noises. This happened on the phones, but it also happened on the radios and on the televisions. One other famous sighting of Mothman happened. It was actually the same day. It was reported a little later. It was the same day. It was about 90 minutes before. And there was a man, I can't remember his name, I've got it in here somewhere, but there was a man who claimed to have seen Mothman that day as well. He claimed that his television set reception was disrupted, and he was hearing these weird, like, how do you describe them? He said they were kind of like generator noises coming from outside.
That is weird.
Yep. And once these noises started...
I'm assuming like a gas generator then
right.
at that point in time. So like an engine running?
I guess.
Almost?
But it's weird to me. I mean, we have a gas generator up at our cabin
yeah.
in the woods. And it's definitely a different sort of sound from
yeah,
an engine.
Yeah, different
but
kind
it's,
of engine.
It's similar.
Okay.
In any case, he hears this generator noise. His TV reception suddenly starts breaking up and having an issue. He goes outside to check, and he sees two glowing red eyes looking at him from a, I think there's a tree line. His dog runs into the tree line and never comes back. After his dog disappears, the lights, the glowing red eyes, the lights, they disappear. The generator noise stops. His television goes back to normal. But 90 minutes later, this car full of couples, 90 minutes later, they drive past a dead dog in the TNT area, whose corpse then disappears a few moments later. So it's weird stuff like that.
Okay. Did he report that to the police department as well?
That's a good question. I found that one on the actual newspapers.com like
crazy.
Web archive.
Yeah.
And it was two or three days. It was like November 18th, November 19th. I'll find it and put it in the notes. But yeah, I'm going to say he most likely did because the majority of people, especially at the beginning, they did. Whereas the further out it got, they didn't because you have this idea change from like, it's a big bird, it's something weird, into it is something to do with these UFOs, and that makes me sound crazy, and it also isn't a bird, and that makes me sound crazy. And so I'd wager that he did. Now, phone calls in general as well had, and we'll get more into this in part two as well, they had some problematic things happening. In addition to the beeps, the squeals, the sped up voices, this and that and the other, you also have a lot of strange accounts, like, for instance, with John Keel. So John Keel comes into town. He does this fantastic thing where he essentially cold calls people, but instead of calling them, he knocks on their door. So he's just going around from house to house, knocking on people's doors, saying, like, have you seen anything weird lately? Have you seen anything you can't explain?
I don't know. Man on my doorstep, maybe.
Right? And he actually has this great little anecdote about how earlier he's like driving home from a UFO conference he gave a talk at.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 a.m. At this time, he has a beard, and so beards weren't really in fashion. It's like 2 a.m. He knocks on a person's door, and they're just terrified, and they tell all of their friends that the devil showed up and asked to use their phone. Like, he was great. He was interesting, and that he did the legwork. That's one of the big things about Keel is he didn't wait for the reports to come to him. He went to the reports, and because of this, he ended up giving the number at the room at the hotel he's staying to a lot of people. He's calling people for follow-up reports, and near the end of this phenomena, he has people being like, oh, I forgot to tell you when we talked on Thursday about this thing. He said, what do you mean? What do you mean we talked on Thursday? He's like, we talked on Thursday. We had a conversation. You called me on the phone. I didn't call you on the phone. He has multiple people telling him this, that he's calling them when he is not calling them. And other people experience this as well. People call him, have strange conversations. There's one UFO researcher named Gray Barker, who he is very familiar with and very friendly with. He gets a call from Gray Barker. Gray is talking to him like they've never met before. And Gray tells him to follow up on this certain case, but he mispronounces the name of the witness. Even though they had talked about this case 100 times before, never mispronounces this name before. It's like this weird mimicry. And so the phone company is like a whole nother thing, which again, we're going to get into a lot more in part two. But all of these things come together, right? The Mothman, the UFOs, the weird phone calls, they all come together into one person, and that one person is John Keel's, like, partner in crime in Point Pleasant, Mrs. Mary Heyer. Now, Mary, she saw a UFO. She kind of had a Mothman experience. She was harassed over the phone, and she was a reporter for the Point, or she was the Point Pleasant correspondent for the Athens, Ohio Messenger, and was well known and well liked by pretty much everyone in the community. The two did develop a strong friendship, and they worked very closely together. They met through this mutual interest of theirs, UFOs and the Mothman. Now, Mary was trusted by people in the community. Mary, people would see a UFO, they'd come to her. They wouldn't go.
Wow, she also died in 1970.
She did die in 1970, which is
the age of 54.
Yes, theories, I guess. Yeah. It wasn't something that necessarily was, like, she was sick for weeks, right? But not something that they had anticipated before that.
She was sick.
Right. It wasn't like, she was. It wasn't like
poison.
You are an unhealthy person who has such and such a time to live. It was pretty strange. And there's this supposed, like, Mothman curse that we're going to get into. Yeah, so she dies, which is sad. But before she dies, she does a lot of good stuff. Like I said, she is the one who would write your story if she believed it and believed you. And just like John Keel, she said, to be an excellent judge of character, she will accompany John on a lot of his visits and things like that, because her being there opens people up. I mean, the backwoods of West Virginia are not really a great place to be a stranger. Not a really open and trusting place, I would say. But with Mary there.
Yeah, familiar face, familiar name.
Then people are more willing to talk to you.
Less intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what happens, in fact, the first time that Keel and Heyer meet, which is on December 7th, the day that John Keel rolls into Point Pleasant looking for Mothman and looking for the UFOs. Now, after visiting the homes of some UFO witnesses, he gets wind of this Mabel McDaniels, who would go on to have her own Mothman experience, but at the time, she was significant because of a UFO experience, a UFO witness. She was a UFO witness. And B, she was also the mother of Linda Scarberry. Now, Mabel welcomes John Keel in. They sit down. They're chatting about her own little UFO experience. And then Mabel calls her daughter, her daughter's husband, calls the Mallet couple, calls Mary Heyer, calls Mary's niece Connie, and calls Connie's fiance Keith. They all come over. And they basically just sit and talk about Mothman for a few hours. And the couples in the car, they give their own accounts. Each one gives their own specific individual account. Keel records all of these. And then Connie gives her account. And basically, the thing about Connie is she has a compelling story for a few different reasons. The first one is that her story occurs in broad daylight. Mothman was seen quite a few times in the middle of the day. Like, just straight up, no filter. There is a giant 7 foot tall winged humanoid chasing my car. And Connie was one of these people who experienced that. It was 10:30 a.m. on November the 27th, 1966. She was passing by the Mason County Golf Course outside of New Haven, and she spotted a large gray figure. Just like all the others, it was 7 feet tall, or just like all the others state, it was 7 feet tall. It had glowing red hypnotic eyes. Its eyes unfolded from its back. It rose silently off the ground like a mute helicopter without flapping its wings at all. Like I said, this is one of those things that Keel put together and says, that is a really strangely specific detail here and completely against what we would think would be the case. It rises off the ground and it makes a beeline towards Connie's car, unlike the Scarberry Mallet sighting with Connie. Mothman is not following her car. Mothman is coming at her car head on. almost colliding with her vehicle and then passing overhead. And like the others, she states that she felt hypnotized by these eyes drawn in. She said it's a miracle that she didn't run the car off the road because she was having trouble focusing on anything other than these two red eyes. Now, the other thing that makes Connie's account pretty compelling is that Connie, even a week and a half later or so, was suffering from Klieg's conjunctivitis. Now, you all may know conjunctivitis is pink eye, right? I don't know exactly what causes pink eye, but anytime I got it as a kid, it's because, like, a kid peed in the pool, and then I opened my eyes, which is gross.
The chlorine didn't kill that? Is that what it's there for?
I don't know. Well, and maybe chlorine causes it, too. I don't know. Because, like,
just makes your eyes red, dude.
Typical conjunctivitis is a bacteria, a virus, or irritation, things like that. Whereas Klieg's, or Klieg's, it's not referred to as pink eye as much as it is referred to as eye burn. It's also known as actinic conjunctivitis, and it only occurs when the eye has been exposed to light of a very short wavelength, such as ultraviolet light.
Oh, it's like snow burn.
What's that? It's like when you're skiing?
Yeah, when you don't wear goggles.
Yeah.
It's the reflection of the light off the snow that, just destroys your eyes.
Yeah, it's just like
that. It hurts them like nuts because of all the bounce of light.
Yeah, it's that ultraviolet light getting into the eyes. Apparently, a lot of kids in Ecuador have it. Because, I don't know, because, like, the atmosphere is thinner or something, and so more UV light gets in.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is strange. That's just, like, a little tidbit I found that has nothing to do with this.
Crazy. But, okay, so that's weird, because I thought, oh, lighter eyes get burned easier.
Right.
So that's, like, the first thing that I connected the dots to, and then snow burn is, like, the probably most normal.
Yeah.
At least in our neck of the woods.
right. We got a mountain like a minute away.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, probably same thing over oceans.
Probably. Yeah. The reflection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I guess maybe Ecuador. I don't know. That's weird.
Now,
that's weird stuff, man.
Now, Kiel says that seeing her eyes, even necessarily, I mean, her story, to me, it's believable enough. To Kiel, it was believable enough. But what really convinced him was seeing her eyes. And it's because in his own reporting and his own experiences and research, Kiel had come across a number of unrelated UFO cases wherein individuals would stare at a luminous UFO for any period of time, whether it was a second, an hour, whatever, and then they would come away with that eye burn.
Well, I feel like that's more like common sense.
Well, yeah, just don't stare at bright
things. Don't look into a ball of light.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, we've got one in the sky at all times.
Right. Don't look at that one.
Yeah. Now, probably the same thing will happen.
It's true. Now, actually,
that's where we get our UV.
Did you look at it during the eclipse?
Gosh darn it,
but I had, like, a piece of paper, and I was, like, moving it. Basically, I couldn't find eclipse glasses, and I was not going to miss this damn eclipse. And so I stared at the sun, and I'm sorry to my mom, and I'm sorry to everyone who loves me. Good news is I didn't get eye burn. We're fine. I did for like 2 days when I closed my eyes. I could see the eclipse, and so I was a little concerned.
That's a little worrisome, yeah.
But it turned out fine. So
Sam. I did a whole special on it.
I know, you did. And you told me all the places and ways to get eclipse glasses.
Did that.
I welcome your hate mail.
It's a betrayal.
Everyone. Anyway. I'm sorry. That was stupid of me. So, yeah. So, he has seen multiple people with this conjunctivitis, especially in conjunction with UFOs. This is what convinced him not only of the veracity of Connie's claims, but also that Mothman was something more than just a bird or any other natural phenomena. Now, there's one other famous case of conjunctivitis that occurs during this period, and it happens to a young couple who declined to share their names for reasons that soon become apparent. Now, Kiel talks about, in his book, he talks about how he doesn't like witnesses who will not name themselves. witnesses who say like, oh, I want to tell you this, but I have to remain anonymous. He doesn't like that. He feels like if you have something to say, you say it. He's very much like a good old fashioned values kind of guy in that way. But his experience here in Point Pleasant changes his mind, because you have, not only do you have the public ridicule, which is a constant, but you also have this other side of the spectrum wherein people who revealed their names during UFO sightings, Mothman sightings, suddenly they were being harassed not by skeptics, but by believers. You had people knocking on your doors at all hours of the day and night, wanting to come and sit and talk to you. People accusing you of things like cohorting and cavorting and, I don't know, all of those words. Being in cahoots with...
Yes, the cahoots!
The cahoots. Being in cahoots with the phenomena. And basically just stalking in your own kind of way. As well as another very specific instance.
I think they're stalking in kind of all the same ways.
That's true.
I think there's a generalized version of stalking, and that's what these people do.
Right. As well as another form of harassment that we'll get into a little later. The kids, though, and seeing all of this, Keel said, okay, I guess I understand. I guess I will accept some reports from unnamed sources if they are convincing enough. The kids, though, they aren't worried about this. They're worried about the fact that they were kids at 10:30 at night in a car. Essentially, these kids are doing what kids do, teenagers do, at 10:30 p.m. in a parked car in the dark, when suddenly a bright bluish-white light floods the car. At first, they think it's the cops. And
makes sense.
Right. And so they look to see what it is.
Oh, man, my mom's going to kill me.
His exact thing is like, they wish to remain anonymous because, and then in quotation marks, it says, her father would kill me.
So, I love it.
I know. So they look out. Oh, crap, we're in such trouble. It's the cops. We're, you know, in various states of undress. They don't see the cops. What they see is a blue ball of fire.
Just what? I thought we were talking about Mothman.
A few feet from their car, they see a blue ball of fire floating off the ground. Now, they also report hearing this low hum. They feel like they're staring at it for just a few seconds.
Like a...
Sure.
Okay.
Yes. They feel like they've only been staring at it for a few seconds, and they are scared out of their minds. They drive home. They wake up the next day, and both of them are heavily sunburned. The boy has a case of actinic conjunctivitis that swells his eyes nearly shut.
Yikes.
For 2 weeks. Both families attest that the kids did not have this burn earlier in the evening. Therefore, the only time they could have gotten it, by the time they left and the time they woke up, was the middle of the night. They
got
a
sunburn. That's why you don't stare at spotlights.
I don't know that a spotlight...
It doesn't produce UV.
...will sunburn you.
It won't.
The other weird thing about it is that, like I said, they said, okay, we stared at it for a second, then we got home. They see it at 10:30 at night. They don't get home until 12:30. They've lost 2 hours of time. Now, Keel believed them, and it was because, like I said, he took one look at them. He saw they were burned. The boy still had conjunctivitis. He believed what was going on. So you have this new idea that Mothman causes pink eye, which is a really just like, yeah, I know. It's a really not technically correct way of saying it, but it's one of my favorite things. And I saw like a meme once of like sad Mothman because he has no friends because he gives everyone pink eye.
Well, maybe that's just part of like the transformation. Like eventually you just get giant glowing red eyes and sprout wings. Maybe he just wants more friends.
That could be it. I agree with that.
Amazing.
Now, back home on the ranch, however, Connie has told her story. Keel has accepted her story. The gang, consisting of everyone in the house, decides that they decide to go to the TNT area. It's around 9 p.m., so the sun has set at this point. And when they arrive, the gates are locked. for a few weeks. Again, this is December 7th.
Well, I'm sure that makes so much sense. You got all these kids going out trying to find Mothman.
Mm-hmm. That's what's interesting. Nobody really cared about locking the gates to the wildlife preserve before Mothman.
Well, yeah, then you had hoaxers. You had a whole bunch of other stuff coming up. I mean, there was guys that tied lights, red lights, to a balloon and let it float around. There's a dude that cut his engines while flying his little personal airplane and almost flew it into a hillside because he was trying to scare people gliding it back and forth over the river.
What a jerk. I wish he had
enthralled by the idea of Mothman and, becoming Mothman. There is people that dressed up and actively fabricated stories as well. And Mothman had a grip on Point Pleasant for a solid year.
I found a beautiful article. I think it's also from the Raleigh Register, wherein he talks about Mothman was discovered by West Virginians for West Virginians in West Virginia.
That sounds correct. Yeah.
It became part of the statewide identity.
I'm
and a little bit on Ohio as well.
It's not their state bird.
I mean, that's fair.
That would be so awesome.
That would be pretty cool. Now, they decide, okay, we're going to the TNT area. The gates are locked, but they can still squeeze in for the few
weeks. They can still trespass?
Yes, they can still trespass.
I know how you feel about trespassers.
I have a double standard about trespassing. I have a double standard because
sometimes you just got to go find the truth.
Isn't it? It's like government land.
It is, right? Technically, yes.
I feel like, you should never trespass.
But if it's on government land, it doesn't matter.
UFOs or Mothman on government land, it's a lot better than going onto someone's private land. However, please don't trespass. Don't.
So the moral of this story is trespassing is a gray area.
Nope, trespassing is grays. Straight up don't do it. Ah-ha-ha, full of grays.
You see that? Yeah.
Don't trespass. But they trespassed. And they decide the first place they're going to go is the power generator plant, which is where they had seen Mothman kind of shamble towards. That's the other thing. He shambles. He shimmies. He walks like a penguin. That's what people say.
He walks like a bird, you say?
I mean, a flightless bird, but yes.
Okay.
So he shambles towards the power plant generator. The power plant. That's where they go first. Now, the nervousness, the fear of everybody was real, according to Keel. There was no putting on of airs. There was no faking it for his benefit. People were uneasy. And when it came time for them to enter into the power plant, the only two people who went with him were Connie and Keith. Now, Connie, even though everyone was a little spooked other than Keel wasn't spooked because he hangs out in abandoned buildings all the time. It's just part of what you do when you're a ufologist. Connie is spooked, but she's in a good mood. She's making jokes. Maybe it's the awkward kind of making jokes and you're actually really freaked out.
I think it's
out.
A coping mechanism. Yeah,
yeah. I think so. But she seems okay.
That's what I do.
She was described by Keel as brave, and brave, cheerful, fantastic person. Now, they go through the entire building. He's got this flashlight he keeps referring to it. He calls it his six-celled flashlight, which I assume means it's a really bright flashlight. I don't know why else he wouldn't just say flashlight. But he keeps using his six-celled flashlight, and he's checking the entire building. They get all up and all down through it, and right as they're exiting, Connie looks behind her, and she just starts screaming. She says something to the effect of, "There it is. It's here." And Keith and Keel have to drag her out because she is a wreck. She is crying hysterically. She is sobbing. She cannot move. They drag her out. The other members of the party who had waited outside surround her and start comforting her. And Keel runs back in and he's flashing his flashlight everywhere. He's double checking everything. He goes to the wall that Connie would have seen what she saw at.
Mm-hmm.
And shining his flashlight up and down, it finds nothing. No reflective surfaces of any kind. No Mothman at all, of course. Just doesn't find a single thing. And he does another sweep. He finds nothing at all. He comes back out to the group And at this point, they're all huddled together, staring out across a fence that led behind the, or staring out across a fence that separated the back of the power plant from where they were. They also had a cop join them. His name was Deputy Alva Sullivan. It wasn't uncommon for cops to patrol the TNT area before Mothman. It definitely wasn't uncommon once there was a Mothman. Yeah,
I'd say it's definitely common.
Yeah. But Mary Heyer's there. Everybody knows Mary Heyer. She's great. So the cop's like, ah, sure. Let's hang out. I'm a deputy of
Man,
the law.
Man, the benefits of living in a small rural community.
Yeah, seriously. And so they're all looking out across this fence. They all say, oh, John, there you are. And he says, what are you looking at? And he said, they say, we saw something run. We saw a man running back here. And he says to Silva, Sullivan, did you see that? He said, yeah, we saw a man running here. And he said, well, it wasn't me. I went in through that front entrance. I came out through that front entrance. So it wasn't me. And then they say, okay, well, what about that loud noise, that loud metallic banging noise that came from inside of the power plant when you were in there? And he said, what? What are you talking about? And they say that they heard something as if it had fallen from the top of the plant, hit some stuff on the way down, and then crashed at the bottom, is what they heard. And Keel, within this building, didn't hear a single darn thing about it. Now, all of a sudden, Mary Mallett's ear starts to bleed. Out of nowhere, Keel says that he believed it was due to a concussive force, something that rapidly changed the air pressure, and wondered if it was somehow associated with that metallic sound they had heard just a few minutes before. Everybody else goes home, but Keel returns later that evening for further investigation. Now, he doesn't see Mothman or anything, but he does experience one very, very strange thing, and it's what he can only identify as a zone of fear. It is a clearly defined area about 15 feet long that Keel, upon stepping into, instantly felt unnerved, unsettled, and just straight up terrified. Then he walked out of it, and it ended completely. He traversed it two or three times, and each time he felt totally fine, entered the zone of fear, was scared out of his mind, exited, and was totally fine. On the last pass, because he's doing it multiple times to try to find what is going on? Like, can I find any apparatus? He hears no sound. He sees no lights. What is happening here? And finally, he goes through it one more time, and he says it was so psychologically painful to go back through it that final time, he seriously considered just sitting down and waiting until daybreak, even though he could see his car from where he was sitting. He just said, I just don't want to do that anymore. But he makes it. In the morning, he goes back. He finds absolutely nothing or out of the ordinary. No down telephone lines, no gas leaks, nothing at all. And it is one of those stranger parts of the story. And I mean, we've talked about fear quite a few times. We've talked about infrasound. We've talked about what else causes fear?
Electromagnetism. Monoxide poisoning.
But I feel like if it was monoxide poisoning,
it would dissipate.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be like on and then off, right?
Probably not, no.
Because that's...
There's several things that can cause paranoia, though. I mean, it's not...
Drugs.
Yeah. Sam, no.
All these different things that we know to cause...
Yeah, we can't pick it up from our normal senses, but yeah. It does have a physical effect to us.
Anyway, so yeah, he wasn't able to find absolutely any indication of what could have caused it either that night or the following morning. Now, we definitely have a lot more to talk about here, so don't go anywhere, but we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors. Guys, we all know how difficult being an independent content creator can be. Sometimes you just don't have the resources to get that special something to set your production apart from the pack. And that's where this week's sponsor, VideoBlocks.com, comes in.
By going to videoblocks.com, by utilizing their service, you can immediately get access to over 100,000 stock footage clips. Now, we're talking After Effects templates. We're talking HD footage up to 4K, motion background templates and effects. Videoblocks.com has everything you need to break down the barrier between independent content creator and professional content creator. This stuff looks professional because it's made by professionals. And the amazing thing about Videoblocks.com is, in addition to the hundreds of thousands of video clips that they have that you get included, no extra cost included with your subscription, if there is something that's not included in the member libraries, you're going to automatically save 40% off of that normal price. The nice thing about it as well, again, in the vein of independent content creators, is that 100% of the money you spend on any clip goes directly to that clip's creator. So not only are you getting a great deal, you can feel good about it as well, knowing that you're helping other people live their passion just like they're helping you. The amazing thing about videoblocks.com is that all of the content is royalty-free. You can use it for commercial purposes, or you can just use it for a nice little at-home video, or who knows, maybe a little podcast promotional video, you know, that sort of thing. It's all royalty-free, and that includes even after your subscription has ended with videoblocks.com. You will never, ever get dragged into a royalty fight. You're never going to have to contact this person or that person again. You are just going to need to go to videoblocks.com, type in what you need, and just be amazed at the high-quality stock footage that they have to offer. Now, if you go to videoblocks.com/notalone, you're going to get 84% off an annual subscription after a 7-day free trial. That's 84% off just by going to videoblocks.com/notalone. You're looking at just paying $149 for an entire year's worth of stock footage, and again, royalty free. That price, that's all you're paying. So guys, go to videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee if you are in the independent content creation game, or even if you're not, even if you're in the professional content creation game, videoblocks.com is the most amazing resource out there. And guys, I gotta tell you, it's amazing. All right, back to the show.
Now, as we had mentioned previously, there was absolute full-blown saucer mania happening during this time as well.
We're talking about them flying saucers.
Yeah, see? And that was a term. Saucer mania. It's probably my favorite term,
I
would say.
Every time I think saucer, I think like a saucer of milk for some reason. That's like fair. Old school Tom and Jerry is what I think of.
Well, I mean, that's what a flying saucer is. I know. It's one of those flying.
Whoa. Full of milk?
Yes. Full of something. Now, Mary Heyer recalls once receiving over 500 reports of UFO activity in a single weekend during the peak of this UFO flap. The UFOs were being seen by all sorts of people and were described in all sorts of ways. One of my favorites is also one of the first to occur during this flap in Point Pleasant. Now, unlike Mothman, who started appearing in November of 66, the UFOs had a good head start, with articles written in publications such as The New Yorker in April of that year, referencing the national saucer phenomena. However, many reports came even before that. Now, this one happened in March 1966. It comes from Point Pleasant, and it is that of Mrs. Kelly, who prefers not to share her real name. She was waiting for her children in her car near the Point Pleasant school, where she was picking them up from, when she saw hanging low in the sky a glistening metal disc hovering directly above the school playground. There was a door-like opening in the craft, and a man in a silvery, skin-tight suit with long, whitish, silvery hair standing outside the object, floating in mid-air. She looked at the...
Above an elementary school.
Above an elementary school. She looked down.
How many other people recorded that?
She looked down at the kids on the field or on the playground. They weren't all paying dead. Any time. No. That's terrible.
Murder.
Murder. Most foul. They weren't paying any attention. They didn't seem to see the saucer gentleman or the saucer itself. She was the only person she could tell that could see it.
What?
Yep. And...
She's the chosen one.
When she looked back up to see if it was still there after examining the expressions of the children...
She's there to balance the force.
There we go. It was gone. Completely and totally disappeared. She did not tell anybody because she thought she had seen an angel. And
of course.
Yep. And she did not report it until, like we said earlier, John Keel would go cold calling and he would just knock on people's doors and be like, "You see the aliens? You see the aliens? Tell me about it. Tell me about the aliens." Although he actually, I mean, we'll get more into it.
He was a bit more subtle.
He was a bit more subtle. He also didn't believe that they were extraterrestrials. So there's that.
You just thought they were terrestrials?
Not necessarily.
Oh.
We'll talk about it.
Sky people?
Sky folk? No. Although he was a very
Airbender.
Folksy. He seemed very folksy in that he always referred to Mothman as some kind of critter.
Some kind of critters out
some
there.
Some kind of critter in these there hills.
Oh, I love it.
It was beautiful.
I'm gonna describe everything as some kind of critter now.
It's some
you know,
kind of critter.
I was at work the other day and I saw some kind of critter.
Oh no, that doesn't sound good. Now Mabel McDaniels also saw a perfectly round sphere in the sky that summer, and a number of locals saw another round object hovering above Tiny's restaurant, which is right across the street from the McDaniels family home.
Wait. Tiny's restaurant?
Tiny's restaurant.
This is amazing. I think we should just move to West Virginia.
I think Point Pleasant sounds like a very pleasant point to live in. But I like
I feel like Point Pleasant sounds like the location of like a DC hero. Like, I feel like that's where the Flash is actually from.
That's fair.
It's not Central City. It's Point Pleasant.
Yeah, it is a DC hero. Yeah. It's Mothman.
No, Mothman.
Now, the UFOs were seen all over town in Point Pleasant, as well as the entire Ohio River Valley, with multiple spottings in the TNT area, a large number of them across the Ohio River and Gallipolis, but also on the river itself. At about 2 a.m. on the same day that Keel and Company were investigating the TNT area, a young man living a bit further up the river woke and looked out the window to see a brightly illuminated object floating in the air just above the water. Now,
probably one of those darn balloons lit up again.
Right? Those darn weather
kids.
Balloons.
Those darn kids.
I don't believe in weather balloons. Just like I don't
weather
believe
balloons
in
are
owls.
Real.
I don't care.
Owls are also very real.
I don't believe
real.
In owls. Owls
I don't believe,
are not real.
I don't believe
there's
in the Mothman.
Not a real. That's fine.
I don't believe in Keel.
I don't believe in owls.
What?
I don't think they
Sam,
exist.
Sam, you have one right there on your book.
Shh. It's beautiful. Now.
Right, it's a beautiful owl.
This motif would be repeated a number of times. This idea of UFOs floating above the river. Very often, when a mystery craft was sighted by an individual on the riverbank, they would then be surprised to see a spotlight come out from one of the boats on the river, having identified it as well. Now, this same sort of thing happened just a few hours later that same night, wherein there was a Mr. Hearn of Cheshire, Ohio, who viewed another unidentified object, a red light, on the opposing riverbank. This happened, I think, around 4 in the morning as he's walking his dog. Now, he sees this red light, and he sees little diminutive silhouettes running around and moving around in the light. He hurries home, wakes up his wife, who he then grabs and makes run back with him. They can't figure it out together, so then they wake up their neighbors, the Taylors, which I don't care what
as
you're
in,
seeing.
Like, Tim Taylor.
Tim the Tool Man Taylor. I don't care what you're seeing. You don't wake your neighbor up at 4:30 in the morning. That's rude.
Maybe they're really good friends. You don't know that.
I just have a hard time believing that.
Sam, the next time I see something at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm coming down here and I'm waking you up.
You can't. The Taylors go with them. They view this phenomena as well. And while they're there, the lights start flashing. alternating between red and orange. The lights then turn off completely and are replaced by one very bright green light that rises straight into the air and disappears.
So are we even talking about the Mothman anymore? I feel like we're just talking about weird
We're talking
lights.
About UFOs.
Okay.
That's what I was telling you.
Yeah.
This story has so much more than just the Mothman.
I feel like we're just getting extremely off topic.
No. It's all within the topic. Mr. Hearn told Mary Heyer, as she was interviewing him, "I've lived on this riverbank since I was 12 years old. I know every boat light, and this was definitely something I've never seen before." Now, even John and Mary had their own joint experiences. At one point, while observing an area known as Gallipolis Ferry, John had staked out a good little viewing spot on a hill there. Now, he noticed that every night, a reddish window of light would appear about 3 to 4 miles away from him at exactly 10 p.m. It would just appear, as if someone had just turned on a powerful spotlight. And initially, Keel thinks this is someone's house, this is a spotlight, this is someone's car. He tries his best to get to that area, but he finds it completely, there's no road. The hike to get up there would just be too long and too exhausting. There's no homes over there that he can tell just by observing it in the daytime. And yet every night, this light is just turning on. Now, on Thursday, the 6th of April, 1967, he brings Mary along with him. At 10 p.m., the light comes on just like always, but another light switched on to the north of their position in the same area where John had seen a glowing disc descend a few nights previous. He knew for a fact that there were no homes or even roads out there that could be causing that particular glow, and both of the lights begin to slowly move through the trees. John, using that big old six-celled flashlight again, whatever that is, he signals to one of the lights. He flashes it 3 times, and instantaneously, 3 extremely bright flashes come back from the area of this light, and then the red light rises upwards until it's about 100 feet above the trees. It then disappears as if someone has flipped off a switch. Mary Heyer was in a shock and would later sign a legal notarized affidavit detailing what she saw and what she believed to have happened. Now, all of these are nice little UFO stories. They're mm-hmm. good for setting the tone, setting the mood, but there's one individual that, when you say Mothman, is maybe even more famous than John Keel himself. One individual who, even though he has not a lot to do with Mothman, is always associated with this time in history. Now, this man's name is Woodrow Derenberger. His friends called him Woody, and he claims to have met a man from another world.
Oh, God.
I get the feeling that he and Jason would probably kill each other.
No, he's probably dead.
He is dead. But they would probably murder each other if put in the same room.
No, I that's harsh. That is harsh.
I don't think so.
I think I would probably have a great disdain for an individual.
I think.
But why don't you tell me the story
with the
here?
The hostility you regard me for saying these things, secondhand reporting. I can't even imagine the hostility you would have if you met an actual contactee.
Sam, it's not hostility, it's criticism.
I think it's a little bit hostile.
No, it's hostile to the source material.
All right.
Not you specifically.
Well, I feel pretty hostile to you specifically sometimes.
That's the nicotine cravings talking, true. Sam.
Now, before his experience, Woody was just your average everyday salesman. He worked in the town of Parkersburg, West Virginia, and lived in the nearby town of Mineral Wells. Parkersburg is about 50 miles away from Point Pleasant. Now, he was driving home from work around 7:30 p.m. on November 2nd, 13 days before the arrival of Mothman. Derenberger was heading back home to his wife and 2 children, driving along Interstate 77. Now, suddenly he is cut off by something that he can describe only as a dark, long object that was traveling about the same speed as his truck. It appeared to be moving forward, but slowly decreasing its speed, when suddenly it rotated sideways and came to a complete stop. Now Woody slammed on his brakes and stopped just 10 feet from it. It exuded no visible light, but by the light of his headlights, he was able to see that it was floating approximately 10 inches above the highway. It had the appearance of what he called an old kerosene lamp globe, having a flat bottom and a dome-like top. It was charcoal gray. The side of this craft opens, and a man steps out and approaches the truck. As far as I can tell, they're in the middle of the road. Like, he makes no note of, like, and then I pulled over. He just stopped dead in the middle of the road. As the man steps out of this craft, it ascends and hovers about 50 to 75 feet in the air for the next 10 minutes. Now, the being comes into focus. He's about 5 feet 10 inches tall. He has long dark hair combed back. He was extremely tan. He appeared to be about 35 to 40 years old. He looked like he weighed about 185, and he walked with his hands crossed and his hands, or with his arms crossed and his hands tucked in to his armpits to keep them warm. He had a grin that did not leave his face the entire time during the encounter. Now, Woody claims that he didn't hear an audible voice as the man approached, but he knew the man wanted him to roll his window down, and Woody found himself unable to resist.
Well, I mean, you see anyone coming towards your vehicle.
One time, I was in... One time, I was in Catherine Albertson Park. Or no, I was in Julia Davis Park. I was on my way to prom, I think, and I was driving my dad's car, and I was driving in this park, which is where the homeless people of Boise hang out. And there was this homeless gentleman who stood in front of my car in the parking lot and made the roll your windows down motion. And I, like, put my hand over and acted like I was, and then he came over, and then I just sped away. So, no, don't roll your windows down for just anybody. Roll them down for friends and family and no one else. The world is out to hurt you.
Well, how are you going to make new friends and family if you don't roll down the window?
If you're old enough to be listening to this podcast, you're old enough to not need any more friends.
Sam.
At a certain point, and that point is 19.
Right here.
You don't need new friends.
Okay. Wow, are we explicit?
What?
Are we explicit content?
What? I didn't say anything.
You said 19.
Yeah.
Like, younger folks than 19 can listen to this.
No, I'm just saying in general. Yeah, no. Yeah, younger folks can listen. I'm just saying, when you're 19, you don't need new friends.
All right.
Grab all the friends you want. Everyone else is just an acquaintance.
That is so depressing, Sam.
No, it's true. You know it's depressing. True. All right. Now, he rolls down the window, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
Well, he's a well-dressed man, or was he just like...
He was well-dressed. He was wearing, like, a shimmery silver gold or silver greenish blue skin tight suit.
Dope.
Yeah. It was good. It's good. And I think he was wearing like a real suit over that as well. So
okay.
Now, it's weird that they rolled down the window because the man never speaks. He communicates entirely nonverbally with Woody. And he starts with that time tested line, "Do not be afraid. We mean you no harm." Woody claims that he is told that he comes from a country much less powerful than yours. And then this being asks him his name. Woody says, "My name's Woodrow Derenberger." And he says, "My name is Cold. I sleep, breathe, and bleed, even as you do. I am a searcher." "What kind of a place is that?" He nods towards Parkersburg. And Woody is put in this weird situation where you have to explain the concept of a city. You have to say, like, well, this is where people go to work. This is where families live. This is where you buy food and where you get born and where you die. And it's a city. And Cold says, "On our world, we call such places gatherings. Now, I want you to report this encounter to the authorities. I will come forward to confirm it later if they or anybody else does not believe you. Goodbye, Mr. Derenberger. we will see you again. As this last line, we will see you again, is being echoed in his head, the craft ascends, the door opens, a hand reaches out and helps Cold back into the craft. Now, Darren Berger stated that because Cold said we'd see you again, he believed that he would see Cold again, and indeed he did many, many times. Much like the TNT area became a place for people to hang out to see Mothman, because Darren Berger mentioned this, his house became the place to hang out to see aliens, and people would just park all up and down his street. And he's one of those prime examples of people who just harassed day and night, unable to get any rest. Now, he later learns that Mr. Cold's first name is Indrid. And Indrid Cold has become a staple of modern urban legend and myth. Some of our listeners may even be familiar with him without knowing about it. If you've ever heard stories of the Grinning Man, this entity is often believed to be Indrid Cold. He pops up from time to time. Nowadays, primarily, he's just the star of creepypastas. But there have been a few more documented sightings, one of which we'll post a link to. It was a story given to the fantastic researcher Nick Redfern, who, like John Keel, is known for his work on the Men in Black. Redfern tells the story of Christine, who had a relationship with the Grinning Man in her childhood. Essentially, do you have any memories, Jason, where it's just like it's a flash of memory from when you're young and you can't really place it and you don't really know what's going on, but it's just like an image?
Yeah, it's bits and pieces.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have like a specific one of seeing my childhood home from a specific angle that just, I don't know why, it just clicks. And it's now what I think of whenever I think of that home. Even though it's like off to the side. So, and I feel like everybody has those things. Just like little bits, little images. Christine's little image is of looking up as if she's in her crib and seeing a man with a larger than life grin, a black fedora, a tan overcoat, and black gloves staring down at her.
That's not freaking creepy.
Yeah.
All right, that's great.
Now, when she was 12...
Oh, perfect.
She and a friend were riding bikes around town. They're from Texas. And they peered through the doors of the Baptist church which had just gotten new carpets. And there was a man inside. He turned and began walking towards them wearing the same black fedora, tan overcoat, same trousers that she had remembered from this little flash of memory, but the difference was she couldn't see his black gloves because his hands were wrapped in bandages, and she didn't see his grin because his entire face, his entire head, was also wrapped in bandages. As she grew and went off to college, she heard other friends telling her their own stories about the Grinning Man, stories about waking up in the middle of the night and seeing this exact figure. Grin, fedora, overcoat, everything, which is how he is commonly described, as well as being pale or even greenish, kind of in comparison to the heavily tanned version that Woodrow Derenberger saw. But seeing this exact being in their rooms, over their beds, that sort of stuff.
Huh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, that was a lot like my paralysis experience.
That's true. It was.
Mm-hmm. Except it wasn't a fedora. It was a bowler hat.
Oh, it was a bowler hat. Mm-hmm. Nice. Mine was like, did you ever play Skyrim?
Yeah.
You know what the Red Guards wear? Their head coverings?
Yeah.
That.
That's not creepy.
It was intense. Yeah. But it was just my wife's bag.
Ah.
Yeah.
See, I actually, created an image.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't me, like, oh, that misinterpreting bag is signals. Just, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Intense. Sleep paralysis.
Dude, it's freaky stuff, man. Now, it is super freaky.
Now, there's a lot more to that story. I'm just kind of popping that in there. We'll put a link to that article on our blog post for this episode if you go to notalonepodcast.com/Mothman1. Now, it's unknown exactly what Indrid Cold is. even without the more modern grinning man mythos, is he an alien? Is he a man in black? Is he a shapeshifter? Is he working with the government? Is he Mothman? What's his relationship to Mothman? That is one of my favorite questions in the world, is how does Indrid Cold relate to the Mothman?
Does he?
That's the thing. He may not at all. It may simply be a coincidence. Other people in, like, the Mothman prophecies in the movie, they try to make it seem as though Indrid Cold is the Mothman in his own little way, and that he just changes shape and changes form. But I believe, based on the text, based on the lore around Cold, as well as everything else,
because they sound very different.
They're very different.
Yeah, like, I don't see a straight different line of connection.
It would be the thought that they can change how they appear to different people, different places. I think that they're two different entities. I think the Mothman's the Mothman, and Indrid Cold is a groovy space alien. That's all I think there. But even then, are they related? Are they not? It's things that people have been trying to figure out for years, ever since this book was published, ever since Derenberger's story first broke, which was the day after. So that happened November 2nd, November 3rd. He went to the press. He told everybody all about it. And you have objective witnesses who said, yeah, I was driving home on, what was it, Highway 77. There was this guy parked in the middle of the road and another guy wearing a weird suit standing next to him. You had multiple people coming up and saying that. And then you have this man and his work partner who were driving home past Parkersburg back to Point Pleasant that very evening, who claimed that pretty much the exact same thing happened to them. And technically he tells this story to Mary Heyer first, and then Mary calls Kiel. They talk about the craft descending. They talk about Cold getting out. They don't learn his name in that one, but they talk about Cold coming out, asking them really basic, weird questions like, where are you going and why are you going there? It's like, I'm going home. What is home? Okay, dude.
All right, man. I get it. You travel a lot, but
you don't have to be a jerk about it. Thank you.
It's where my house is.
The idea of it being a telepathic communication, the craft ascending and descending, these details are nearly identical. And you have, again, we don't know exactly when Kiel talked to this individual, and we don't have this individual's name, but you do also have the same sort of, like, well, Derenberger talked a lot about his experiences, but as far as I could tell in the newspapers and the interviews, it never talks about where his hands were placed, which is a weird thing to talk about anyway, but this other source says the exact same thing. He had his arms folded and his hands hidden under his armpits. So it's the same sort of thing where the wings, right? The wings not flapping. That weirdly specific detail that seems so
out of place.
Out of place, yeah. Who's to say one way or the other? Now, this man, he did not enjoy fame like Derenberger. He did not write a book. He did not supposedly travel the stars like Derenberger would go on to do. He did not get divorced and then marry a woman way out of his league, half his age, as Derenberger would do. Instead, this individual started suffering from insomnia. He began drinking. He had a complete and total personality shift. And one day, he gets a call from a scientist, or actually, it's a scientist who comes to his house, and this person says, shut up. Don't talk about it. Don't tell anybody. You don't want this to be true. You don't want this to happen to you. You don't want your life to end up this way. Just forget about it. You didn't see anything at all.
Why don't they just use the little flashy stick, the mind wiper?
I can't wait to talk about what the Men in Black actually are. It's one of the things I'm most looking forward to.
Do they not
to.
Have it in the 60s? Is
no,
that the problem?
No. It's probably a more modern thing.
Darn. Man, that makes things so much easier. The gig. So much better.
This quote-unquote scientist is most likely one of the first cases of the Men in Black phenomena in this specific story in Point Pleasant in the year of 1966. And this is where we're going to end. And we're going to pick back up next week the story of John Keel, the Mothman, the UFOs, the Men in Black, Point Pleasant, everything. The story of all of us in its own little way. We're going to pick up with that next week for Mothman Part 2, Point Pleasant Part 2. I still don't know what I'm going to name this one. I don't know if I'm going to name it John Keel, Mothman, Point Pleasant, Virginia, or Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Why not just like Return of the Mothman? Mothman, Mothman strikes back.
Mothman strikes back. A new Mothman.
And then we'll get sued. It'll be great.
This is good. What's the last one?
It's better than Solo.
What is it? We got a new Mothman. We've got Mothman Strikes Back, and we've got Return of the Mothman, right?
Yes.
And then we've got the Phantom Mothman, and then we've got the Mothman Wars, and then we've got
Revenge
of the Mothman. And then we have
The Mothman Awakens.
The Mothman Awakens. And then we have The Last Mothman.
This sounds amazing.
This sounds good. I'd be down with this. Let's make these movies. Anyway, that's Mothman Part 1. Big props to Jason for getting through that. And not
screaming.
There's
a whole lot less Mothman than I was expecting. A lot more UFO.
Yeah. That's the thing. This book, Mothman Prophecies. Yeah. You see those four little yellow tabs up top?
Yeah.
Those are Mothman sightings. That's everything else.
So he's just talking about Mothman in the intro, and then the rest is about UFOs.
No, I mean, like, it's back there. Okay. It's scattered throughout. But he also does, like, big chunks of the sightings at once. And so you have, it's seen by over 100 people. It has over 26 individual sightings that he has investigated and called reputable, not to mention all the ones he's thrown out. But the aliens and the Men in Black, the contactees, that's the bigger story.
Yeah, that's a little bit more.
And like if you
and you just throw it onto the table.
If you think this is anything close to crazy, you're so wrong. You are going to have such a bad week.
Oh man. Thanks, Sam. I'm excited.
Next week we are digging into the crazy.
And
I'm digging into learning more about myself and how I prejudge things, because I can be reading this book and be like, okay, Mothman, I believe in that. Personally, I believe in that. Then he starts talking about alien contactees like Woody Derenberger and some other folks. And I sit and I'm like, well, that's just crazy. And he's crazy. And it's like, how can it be that the person that I believe and respect for one thing is the same person I call crazy for the next thing because it doesn't fit with my paradigm? And so I'm doing some soul searching on that.
That's great. I'll come back with just telling him that he's crazy all the time.
All right. That's fair.
Not crazy. He's not crazy. Nah. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
What do we got? What's new? What's happening?
What's new? What's new
going
is,
on?
I told
in the
Chris
front of the
to
podcast.
Send me this. We've got a few things going on.
Ooh.
One of them is that our good friend, Chris Cogswell, joined MUFON. And then he was pretty disappointed by MUFON. Chris, if you'll
what
remember, if you'll remember, Chris is the gentleman with the PhD in the chemical engineering.
He's great.
He's a fantastic person. We should have another episode of The Lowdown, the final episode of The Lowdown, out in the next week or two.
I miss Chris.
He's fantastic. We're thinking about getting...
He understood me.
Chris, write in if you understood Jason. We're thinking about getting together and doing like a monthly movie thing where we just like all watch a movie and talk about it. You could come on that.
Yeah, you're going to schedule on a day that I work.
I don't do that necessarily. That's just how it turns out. Trying to wrangle five people.
Yeah, that's fair.
It is unreal. So I apologize.
You're right. So it's supposed to wrangle four.
You're the only person who works evenings. Everybody else is free in the evening.
Not my fault.
It's not your fault, but it's also not my fault.
That's true.
All right. Anyway. All right. So Chris got disappointed by MUFON.
Why? What was that?
He had an experience.
What was the letdown?
Yeah. So he has decided that we are going to create our own UFO reporting network system.
Dear.
As of now, it is called the Center for Anomaly Testing and Science, which is an acronym that means cats. honestly.
Already, I don't take it seriously.
That's okay. We're looking for a better name. But that's the thing. All of these places have snappy little acronyms. And
you
so
have
we're
to.
Trying
you have
to, find
to have them. A great acronym. Otherwise, you're dead in the water when you... Before you even start.
As far as I can tell, we do not have our website up yet. But, guys, we're giving this a go. Like we're trying to be funny about it and all that, but Chris is dedicated into creating a UFO research organization that is based in science, not based in woo-woo, whatever you want to believe, but taking open-mindedly, analyzing every case we can, going over whatever. I'm a part of it. He's a part of it. Rob Christofferson, Marie Mayhew, we're all a part of it. So if you have any cases, if you have seen anything, let us know. Right now, I'm gonna direct you to the notalone@gmail.com, notalonepodcast@gmail.com email. Send anything there, and I'll forward it on, and we'll see about doing some investigation. So that's one thing. Center for Anomaly Testing and Science. Cats. Secondly, if you got stories, send stories, right? We're still collecting for that. We got about a week left until I'm going to close those, then go through and review all of them, and then cut and paste them into one beautiful episode. So that'll be fun. Listener stories. Merch. We got merch. notalonepodcast.threadless.com. Yeah. Cool. Anything on your side?
Nah.
All right.
We're golden, man.
Let's read some reviews.
Yeah, what else we got going?
We got a few reviews this week.
Uh-oh.
Nothing bad.
Aw.
We got some comments.
Yeah.
They weren't as great, but that's okay. We still Perfect. Love everybody. So, let me see. What did we get? We'd like to thank MD Foodie. We'd like to thank Sunny Graves. And we'd like to thank Bellyfish98. Thank you all for your review. I'm going to read MD Foodie. It says, this quickly became my favorite podcast, which is unreal to me, but all right. Now,
have you listened to other podcasts? Right?
Have you tried out anything else? I'm wrapping up the Mojave incident and want to congratulate you guys. Well-told stories. I dove right in after the Skinwalker Ranch episodes and immediately ordered the book after I finished listening and currently have the Mojave book in my Amazon cart. Enjoy that. That's quite the book. I love the bickering between you guys. LOL. Thank goodness. And please keep the episodes coming. We're here to stay. I'm not going anywhere. I literally have nothing better to do. And I'm here until I die or until, I don't know, maybe I have a kid or something and I got to do that.
Or I murder you, either one.
Yeah, you murder me. Well, that's until I die. So we're here.
Yeah, that is true.
Jason, Fair. Are you going anywhere?
Fair. I'm going to go home later.
Okay, but that's exciting for me. Like, are you here?
I don't know.
Are you a part of this?
Again, I'm just debating on this or starting my acting career, either one, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever takes off first.
If someone wants to give Jason an acting job, there you go. All right, so, and then we have three new patrons.
Ooh.
We have our good friend TJ over at Pints and Puzzles.
Yeah, TJ!
We have Elliot Tolbert.
Yeah, Elliot!
And we have, this one actually just came in right before we Whoa. Stopped this. We have Matt Cantwell.
Yeah, Matt!
Guys, thank you so much for your donations. They are fantastic. We appreciate it so much. There's a few different ways to support the show that are great for us. One is Patreon. That is a fantastic way of supporting the show. Costs less than $5 a month, or costs $5 a month or less. Cost of a cheeseburger. I went and bought some McNuggets, or I almost bought some McNuggets from McDonald's today. If I had it, would have cost more than $5. So that's one great way. If you can't do that, leave an iTunes review. Not only does it make me happy, in theory, it helps like our rankings. Who knows?
That's also sweet.
That's
we
also
like
sweet.
Those.
We like those. So that's a good way. If you are an independent content creator with a need, or even if you're just curious about it, or especially if you have an idea or a dream, but you don't know how to like get it fleshed out, get it professional looking, go to videoblocks.com/notalone. Support our sponsors there. That's another really, really great way to help out the podcast. Fourth great way to help out the podcast, tell somebody about it. That's a great way of helping out the podcast. Last way, if you can't do any of those four things, you know what? I believe you. I value you. I love you. You're good. Don't worry about it.
Just listen.
Just listen. And if you can, scream at your wall. That helps.
No, it doesn't.
It helps me.
Jeff isn't in your wall, Sam.
I know, right? He might be, though.
It doesn't matter how many times you scream, he's not going to reply.
That's not true, though.
He got shot, remember?
shot!
That's my Jeff voice.
Jeff was killed.
Isn't that... That was the Jeff voice. Anyway.
I think it was, yeah.
Good. So, great ways to support the podcast. Like I said, if anything else, just be my friend. Be a homie. Hang tight. Loose. I don't know.
Bruh.
Ooh, bruh. All right, Jason, what do you got? Anything you want to say?
No, man. I think you said it.
Okay.
Of course, you can always just reach out to us on any one of the social media platforms.
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Those things.
We have our Facebook discretion group. It's called Remember. It's called Remember We Are Not Alone, a discussion group for the strange or something like that. I don't know. We'll put a link in the show notes. That's fun, though. People go on there. They say things. They post funny memes. They post stories. They post theories. We post the fan art that Clover made us. Yeah, another shout out for Clover, because that fan art made me almost cry.
It was pretty
great.
I'm
not going to lie.
I was like, what?
I was sitting there. I'm like, somebody took who knows how long and made us into these dope little I'm a werewolf, Jason's a chupacabra. It's amazing. That's a great way of supporting this show, too. Cool. Did you do it last week?
I feel like
I did. Yeah, you did.
Yeah, because I did something and you were upset with me about it.
Yeah, usually. just like always. remember.
Side note.
I really got nothing
man,
right
come on,
now.
Dude.
Let me think.
Talk about UFOs. Talk about Men in Black. Anything.
Remember. Whether the devil shows up on your doorstep or you head out at 2 a.m. to chase him down, you are not alone.